Stories from California Cattle Country is produced by the California Cattlemen's Foundation and receives support from the California Cattle Council. We've created this podcast for those wanting to connect with the people and practices of far-flung ranches and dairies in California through hearing stories from and learning more about the families in cattle country. In our California Cattlemen Foundation's weekly media monitoring a few weeks ago, I read an article from the Mercury News written by Will McCarthy about how Livermore may no longer be considered, at least by many, as an agricultural town. In the article, he interviewed Daryl Sweet, a fifth-generation Livermore rancher, who also alluded that the community might be losing its agricultural identity. For those unfamiliar, Livermore is located on the eastern edge of the Bay Area, just under 50 miles from San Francisco. In the last few decades, land prices in the area have risen precipitously. The city itself is nestled in the Livermore Valley, a valley which runs east-west. Historically, the area was critical to railroad infrastructure and agriculture, especially wine grapes, with the Livermore AVA being one of the earliest ones ever created in the state. The Mediterranean climate that was so beneficial for wine grapes also made, oddly, for an ideal place to build sanitariums. The foothills on either side of Livermore Valley are largely pristine, with one exception, windmills. Anyone who's driven through the Altamont Pass, formerly known as Livermore Pass, are certainly aware of the extensive wind farms on either side of Interstate 580. Development of the wind turbines was spurred by the energy crisis in the 1970s. In the early 80s, nearly 5,000 turbines were constructed in the pass. Unfortunately, the first wind turbines built, which are much smaller than contemporary turbines, proved deadly to the area's bird populations, especially birds of prey, like golden eagles, who were particularly affected. Estimates at the time were there was about 4,000 to 5,000 birds that were being killed annually. New turbines are far larger and spin at a much slower speed, with current evidence suggesting that they are, in fact, more safe for bird populations. There's also monitoring technology that can identify bird species and stop the turbines when birds of prey are in the area. The new units are also more efficient. They're just massive. Daryl Sweet's ranch is nestled in the hills on the south side of Altamont Pass, surrounded by these wind turbines. For this podcast, ranches are usually typically a hike. Ranches often exist in places where most people wouldn't want to live, mostly because they're remote. Daryl's ranch is less than an hour from San Francisco and just a few minutes away from downtown Livermore. Looking west from his property, one could see the giant footprint of the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory, which was developed in the 50s by the U.S. government as a reaction to the Soviet Union testing a nuclear weapon. The laboratory became a national laboratory in 1981 and receives the majority of its funding from the U.S. Department of Energy. It's currently managed privately by multiple educational institutions and technology companies. As California's population increases, available property becomes scarcer. Urban encroachment on agricultural areas is nothing new, but in Livermore it's visibly evident. The aforementioned article from the Mercury News, which I'll post a link to in our description, addresses this dichotomy. And that brings us to Daryl. I'm a big fan of Westerns. A common character in many Western films is a newspaper man or some other sort of storyteller. It's critical in a Western's plot that the story is properly related. If no one recorded it, it's thought that, well, it never happened. Daryl's family has been in the Altamont Hills for well over 100 years. If anybody could relate this story, it's him.
How you doing?
How are you?
Good.
I'm glad your family's okay.
Yeah, no, it was great.
It's not too bad, huh?
It's not too cold. Yeah, I brought two coats.
This is not, I don't have a
heater. Oh, yeah. All right, I'm going to follow you up.
Follow me.
All right.
Daryl has a detailed command of the flora and fauna of the area. And when walking up to his house, I saw three wild rabbits taking refuge in his yard, likely spying some sort of predator. He allows swallows to nest under the eaves of his home, despite the mess that they can make. He has a ranch dog named JJ, who was slumbering in the back of his home. And when the wind is particularly crisp, JJ takes the day off. Daryl's a past CCA president, founding member of the California Rangeland Trust, a board member of the Beef Council, among other titles and accomplishments. Daryl accommodated me on relatively short notice. Along with giving directions, he also reminded me to bring a warm coat. He reminded me twice. After all, it's known to be windy there. We toured the property on a side-by-side, and then sat in his kitchen for an interview. I'm Ryan Donahue, and this is Stories from California Cattle Country.
My name is Daryl Sweet. I'm the fifth generation on the ranch here. We're about 6 miles east of Livermore in the Altamont Pass area. And I didn't grow up exactly on the ranch. I grew up in Livermore and on some of the neighboring properties. But anyway, we've been here basically our whole life, other than when we were in college.
Can you speak to a little bit of your family's history on the property?
Sure. So in about 1868, my great-great-grandparents came here as a young couple. Their name were John and Anna Young. They were from Iowa. And they came out here to California. Anna Young came to San Francisco in a covered wagon in the early 1860 during the Civil War. And they came out here. And I don't know how John Young got here. I don't know. But they married. They moved here. Their daughter, their first child, was a girl named Alice. Alice was my great-grandmother. And they settled here in 1868. And then 1879, they built a two-story house, which for this area at that time was, they were the closest town. Actually, it wasn't Livermore as much as it was Mission San Jose. And that was kind of the closest settlement to what they were here. And as I said, their oldest daughter married Richard Sweet, who in about 1883, came here from Canada and Nova Scotia. And they were married, and then they moved to the ranch just adjacent to us, which we still have also. And it's adjacent to us up here in Altamont. Each succeeding generation has managed to keep on to the ranch, and that's what we do.
Was it always operated as a cattle ranch?
No, actually, they dryland farmed a lot of these hills with horses and teams. We've got some great old pictures with, 20 horse teams pulling, harvesters, the grain harvesting equipment. They plowed these hills on horseback, with horseback. They cut hay. It was all really until well in the 1930s. I can remember the older gentleman that owned this place at one time. When I was a kid, he was still cutting hay with a team of horses. And that's how they could go around on these steep hillsides. But while he farmed with the tractor, he cut hay with a team of horses because the mowing they could. And they raised hay and grain. And a lot of the hay that they raised here, they took it over to the river and shipped it down the river to Oakland because of the horse population in Oakland and San Francisco. And that's mostly what these farmers up here did, and ranchers. And they farmed the easier hills that they could get where they could plant crops. And then the steeper country, they ran cattle. Usually the operations, there was a combination of cattle and dryland farming, grain, hay and barley and wheat. And that's pretty much what they did.
I mean, to look at it or just to imagine, I mean, we just went on a side-by-side ride up and down the thing. A lot of times there's ranches because it's not farmable or whatever because of terrain.
Sure.
And I would assume that this was pretty similar, but to imagine someone trying to plow, like, that seems kind of crazy to me.
Yeah. Well, but the fields, like you see around the house here and even these steeper hills, even we farmed with tractors. They farmed these hills until kind of the mid to late 70s. And after that, dryland farming really became, it was a marginal business anyway, because you plant a crop and it doesn't rain, you don't get anything. And so then you got all your money and seed, that sort of thing. And so really dryland farming has pretty much gone out in this area. So, these pastures now are pretty much, this ground is all pasture land.
You guys have a website, I think, for the ranch. I was reading about, can you tell me anything about Ozetta Sweet? Is it Burson?
Ozetta. Right.
It seemed like she was an important figure in your family and seemed to be very interesting. It just, there wasn't a lot more to it. Is there anything you can say about her?
Yeah. No, my grandmother, she lived till the 1980s. So my grandmother married my grandfather was Charles Sweet. And they got married, I think, in 1916. And they moved up here to the ranch and they farmed and they spent some time in Dixon. They had a dairy for a while in Dixon and they came back to these hills. But my dad was born in 1919. So Grandma and Charlie, during the Depression, they still lived here. They also had a place a little closer to town. It was in the country, but it's closer to town. My grandfather during the Depression years, actually left full-time farming and ranching and got a job driving a fuel delivery truck, actually, and delivered fuel and stuff around to farmers and ranchers for a number of years. And then in the 1940s, with World War II, both my dad and his brother were in the service, And my grandfather was ill and passed away in 1950. And so grandma on her own took care of the property while my dad was back in the Korean War after World War II, and she took care of the ranch up here. I was her oldest grandchild, 1947. So I think I was a lucky one from the standpoint that grandma took me to all the agents. She was involved in Farm Bureau and everything, and so I went to all those places. She also had, for this time of year, the thing I remember, one of the most things, is that she loved to have picnics in the wildflowers, when the wildflowers up here. And so grandma took the grandkids and anybody else she could get hold of and would take them on wildflower tours up here. And then she remarried a few years after that, after my grandfather died. And so that's what her name was, Burson, from that standpoint. You know, she was very strong. She always got up every morning and said that she got up and did all her housework and all her work before 7 in the morning and got dressed in case she had an opportunity to go someplace. And so but she and her friends up here, these ranch people were friends for, you know, 50 years or something. And so all these older ladies, they got older, they still had their groups, and they still went to Oakland for lunch, or they'd go to San Francisco or do whatever. But she was very independent. She used to, when my dad was little, she had a horse, and her closest neighbor was about 6 miles away. And she'd put my dad on the front of the horse when he was 6 months old, and she'd ride down to the Mulqueeney family. It was 4 or 5 miles down there. And that's how she would visit neighbors on horseback. So that was the 1920s.
That partially answers my next question. In ranching for so long, there hasn't really been the necessity to communicate what your practices are or what you're doing just for a long time. And then right. with the advent of like social media and all these kind of things, right. becomes more and more important. I believe this is just a partial resume, but you were president of the California Cattlemen's Association. You were on the Beef Council.
Yes.
You're a founding member of California Rangeland Trust. And then part of the National Cattlemen's Beef Promotion and Research Board as well, which is to say you're involved, obviously. I'm very involved. Have you always been that way, or was there something that caused you, some sort of stimulus that caused you to become more involved in like communications and these sort of activities?
I was lucky enough to have when I started high school in 1961, I had an ag teacher. It was a young gentleman, Jim Quella, who really put the ag department on the map. You know, FFA, I participated in the public speaking and a lot of the livestock judging contests, and we did that sort of stuff. But it was also instilled in us that in agriculture, with the kind of changes that were going on, and the changes that went on here at Livermore, as Livermore, during my early lifetime, it kind of went from a ag community, the Lawrence Livermore Lab, was here in the early, the Atomic Energy Commission. It was a lot of growth and a lot of changes. And if you didn't stay active and represent agriculture, there wasn't anybody else left that was going to do that. And I think partly that's, you know, in ranching, that there's enough of us that have dedicated enough time to realize that if we don't put our time and skills in the projects, and, you know, the Beef Council was formed by some real thoughtful leaders in terms of, if we're going to have a beef cattle industry, we're going to have to promote our product and use research and development and techniques to be able to exist. And it's a very competitive world. You know, like the people that started the Beef Council, California's one of the first beef councils in the country, where we collected some money from producers to use for promoting the product. Kind of one thing led to another, that it's all inclusive. You know, there's no use raising beef if we can't sell it, if we can't sell it on a profitable basis. And so, you know, you have those challenges there because there's a lot of competition for the food dollar. It's the same way politically, and if we're going to stay in ranching and keep ranching, then we have to keep the ourselves well represented in Sacramento, which the California Cattlemen Association has done for a long time and continues to do. CCA started over 100 years ago, and we're still going strong, and it's in a state with 40 million people in it. If you're not a strong organization, you know, I think we've done a pretty amazing job, given the population and the state that we're in and stuff, to stay relevant, because, you know, we manage a big percentage of California. The area of California is 30 million acres of rangeland in California. It's about at least a third of California, and probably more if you count some of the forests. It kind of depends on how you calculate it. But anyway, we have a, you know, major role in managing resources in California.
I think it was one of my first interviews was with the Coatmans in Sunol. Talked about the concept, I guess, on the tax form. It's other farm income. Being in ranching, you have to hustle sometimes, and you have to find other forms of income or other ways. I know that you are a founding member of the California Rangeland Trust. We also participate in this land.
There is a conservation easement. There's a mitigation, a conservation easement on about 350 acres of this property.
And what was that to conserve?
It was a mitigation for the large windmills that are next door. And in order for those windmills to get construction permits from U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and California Department of Fish and Wildlife, they have to mitigate for the adverse impacts of their construction project. They mitigate that by conserving similar property. And they're immediately next door to us, and that's how we got included in that.
Your family obviously lived here prior to having wind farms here. Mm-hmm. How was that taken? Has it been awful, or are there some benefits, some not benefits, or how would you describe it? I know it's a big project.
You know, I think the windmills obviously disturbs land. I suppose if I had my choice, I'd like to see everything just remain the way it was before we had windmills up here. But that's the other part of that is that between here and the freeway, that land was in the 90s was purchased by the Alameda County Waste Management Authority, and they were going to put a big garbage dump up here, including right outside our front window here. And so we fought that off. So then it kind of becomes a case of, well, okay, so they wound up putting windmills on the property instead, so that's better than a garbage dump. So, and NextEra has been, you know, good to work with. And these new windmills are not as intrusive. Even though they're bigger, there's fewer of them, and they are not as intrusive as when they had hundreds of small ones, and you can see what some of them look like, but they're still there.
it's impressive. Just on the other side of the property, there's the big, who makes the giant ones?
Yeah.
The big fancy new ones. And then just on the other side, there's a bunch of dilapidated ones. Many of them fallen down, and they're just kind of
right.
just sitting there. Yeah, just abandoned.
Right. It's just an abandoned.
Yeah, just abandoned. Just
junk.
Are they even connected to anything? Like, even if they spin, is it doing
anything? No.
Yeah. I had initially contacted you just because I read something in the Mercury. You were talking about, you kind of mentioned it today too, that the professionals or the landscape of people that live in Livermore has changed over time. You said at one point there's more nuclear physicists in Livermore than like anywhere else in the country. I think in the Mercury there was a quote that said that.
Oh, the only town where you could find a physicist and a rancher and a employee of the gravel company, having a beer together or something.
Sitting at the same bar.
Sitting at the same bar.
What bar is that in Livermore?
I don't know. I'm not. There's enough of them that could be any one of them, but probably the Riata. This is downtown Livermore. Would be one of them that comes to mind. But you know, interesting enough, a lot of our farmers and ranchers around, are basically ranchers, Livermore have been employed at the lab. You know, our ranching operations kind of allow somebody to run cows and maybe the same thing that their family did, but still be able to work outside and run the cows on a part-time basis. There's a lot of that going on because these ranches, like ours, would be too small to make a living solely by themselves. Whereas at one time, but like up here in our place, you know, since basically the Depression, people haven't made a total living on a small farm, and a lot of the wives work, and it's allowed for a lifestyle and a side business and a heritage kind of a business, and people staying in it and still being comfortable. So, you know, I have friends at ranch that work at the gravel pit. I have some that work down here at the lab. As compared to when I was growing up, when there was probably less togetherness, so to speak, because people didn't think they had anything in common. Now it's kind of intermixed where there is a little more understanding, and people, I think, have come to appreciate, like in Livermore, that the surrounding hills and the environment that is around us, that there's an appreciation for it. I don't think people understand maybe that there's a lot of difficulties that come with it, but the point of that article you were talking about is that Livermore's out here and they've got the ranchers and stuff around us. That's also similar in other parts of the Bay Area. Morgan Hill and Gilroy are somewhat the same kind of thing with the ranching and stuff. So we have this inner-urban interface that's kind of evolved over the years, which is kind of interesting. And it's, you know, a lot of people in very rural areas say, oh, gee, I wouldn't want so many people. And that's obviously the traffic and stuff is not a pleasant part of that. But the other part of it is it makes it a pretty interesting environment.
To my understanding, was your father a teacher?
He was. He was a school principal. He was the first one in our family to go to college. And he had some college before World War II and then finished up after World War II.
And you're saying your sister also teaches. She taught science.
Right, yeah.
And you attended Livermore High School, is that right?
I did.
And a big part of that article was kind of talking about how important ag education is, particularly at Livermore High School, because where 30, 40 years ago, the students there might have had some ag experience, it's less likely they do now.
You know, as I mentioned before, is that there's just so many opportunities in agriculture that you can grow up in town and still be involved in agriculture. Agriculture is such a big industry, and there's so many aspects of it. You know, it's not just farming. I think people too often we have FFA, that teaches people to be farmers. That's not necessarily true. You know, maybe helps you get into ag education, but things like public speaking, as I mentioned before, and people raising animals and getting the experience of having to feed an animal twice a day and get it to the fair and get organized, get down there and show the animal and do that sort of thing.
Or all sell it, yeah.
Yeah, then they have to sell it. You know, our ag colleges in California, at Fresno and Cal Poly and UC Davis and Chico, if you talk to a lot of those students up there, they're not all from farms. And we've had this kind of something I had in the 60s when I said I wanted to go into agriculture in high school. You know, ag classes at that time were kind of that, well, if you couldn't do anything else, you could go into agriculture, you know. But if we don't keep people in ag research and education and all that background, I don't think there's a graduate from Cal Poly or Fresno that can't find a job. I know, like in poultry science, for example, at Poly, it's been a long time standing thing that there's, I think Foster Farms has a standing job offer for any graduate that wants a job. Just call them up. Being able to communicate that to urban people, I think, is a really important thing. You know, there's a lot of career opportunity besides just being a farmer.
Well, I want to thank you for allowing me into your home at your kitchen table and for this conversation. I hope to come back and visit soon.
Sure, anytime.
If you'd like to see visuals from our travels, you can visit our website at calcattlecouncil.org or follow us on Instagram at calcattlecountry. We love feedback. If there's anything you'd like to hear on stories from California cattle country, you could contact me directly at ryan@calcattle.org. Thanks for listening. We'll be back in 2 weeks.